The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
My job is not to predict. It's to have a sound analytical framework, to work very hard to be on top of developments, to be able to react. And we're going to have to react. There are going to be some major decisions that we're going to have to make to protect ourselves. And it's going to take a lot of focus, a lot of determination, hard work to play this well going forward. A real challenge, but an exciting challenge.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Part two of the Doug Noland interview is today, Dave, and I'm looking forward to it because there are particular things that a person can do if they can analyze a situation correctly. And, you know, without going into great detail, Doug brings up some great bird's eye view things to do with a portfolio to guard against what's coming.
Well, as you know, in musical theater, there's such thing as a triple threat. And that's someone who can dance and sing and act. And sometimes there is a gifting in one area only. And maybe you just don't go as far if you only have that one particular gift.
Are you saying Doug is a double threat at this point?
He is a double threat. CPA, MBA. Where do we find? You have to know where to look for the details. And then you have to know how to put them in context to know what they mean. And so one is data accumulation. The other is data analysis.
Right.
And I think what makes him a triple threat is then taking it to, and here's what you do about it.
So, well, and it's many years of experience. I mean, I can remember back in the 1990s reading Rischenbacher's letter and thinking, this is one of the best letters about central banking that I've ever read.
Little did you know you were getting some help. He was getting some help from Doug.
Yeah.
Well, without further ado, continue. Continuation of our conversation with Doug Noland.
I want to go back a little bit too, in that for a while I've argued that we're in a unique period in financial history. Throughout history, there's always been constraints on money and credit. I'm saying for the first time ever, there is no constraints globally on the quantity or the quality of credit, unlike anything in history. Because if you think historically, you either had a gold standard, you had Bretton Woods, where, you know, the dollar standard. Probably more importantly, traditionally you had credit was basically expanded through bank lending. And part of the dynamic in bank lending was constrained by capital reserve requirements, the old fractional reserve banking restrained credit growth somewhat. In the 1990s, we went to securitized finance, specifically financing rising asset prices. So all of a sudden, there is no constraint at all on credit. Unlimited supply of credit. And I've argued that capitalism can't function with an unlimited supply of credit, because on the financial side, as we saw during the mortgage finance bubble, you have a huge demand for mortgage credit, and the cost of that credit went down. It wasn't self-regulating. On the one hand, it's been a very, very powerful credit system to expand credit like this, to focus on the asset markets, to focus on financial wealth. Central bankers figured out how to intervene in the markets and backstop this system, to use this system as the most powerful monetary mechanism for stimulus ever. But now they're stuck because they want to inject money into the real economy. They argue there's insufficient aggregate demand, so they want to inject liquidity into the economy, but they've created this massive financial sphere. I break them down into the economic sphere and the financial sphere. You got this massive financial sphere that just gets inflated larger and larger every year because of all this large credit creation every year. It's turned wildly speculative. And the only way they can control this financial sphere and this massive pool of global speculative finance is to continue to force security prices higher. And today, with security prices at a record, and that's bond prices and basically stock prices, it looks sustainable. But I don't think that they can control this global pool of speculative finance much longer. So they're really struggling because their framework, they don't look at this pool of speculative finance that they've created. They look at money and credit as like this mechanism to drive commerce, this medium of exchange, when the key role of money today, as it has been historically, is as a store of value. And it's that store of value that's coming back to keep them, I think, awake at night, because they know if there's any waning confidence in money and credit, you know, they're out of solutions. They've thrown the kitchen sink at this. They've already done, you know, more than whatever they thought it would take in 2012.
This is really critical because, I mean, we're talking about a slight variation on the definition of money. You know, I would say that money is a store of value and medium of exchange, where both of them are important. You're saying that the new definition of money, the change in the nature of money has changed the nature of credit. And the change in the definition of money was to drop the store of value and just leave it as a medium of exchange. That may seem small, but that's a game changer.
Well, it's huge, and it gets back to John Law and his failed experiment. John Law, for those that are unfamiliar, it's just a fascinating part of history. Back in 1717 to 1720 in France, John Law introduced paper money to France, and he was a hero. They used to set up and have a carnival outside his residence because he brought this prosperity to France until the Mississippi bubble collapsed. His whole money and credit system collapsed, and they ran him out of town. And I've read where, you know, in France, they didn't trust banking for 100 years after John Law. And it led to a lot of mayhem. To me, I have a definition of contemporary money. It's a store of nominal value that's highly liquid. People trust it. And the reason money's so important is if people trust it, they basically have insatiable demand for it. And it gets back again to the comment I made about junk bonds. You can only create so many junk bonds, so much junk credit, because people know it's risky and they have a limited appetite for it. This money today, if people trust it, it can be issued as governments have done throughout history in gross excess to the point of a crisis of confidence and a collapse in value. And that's where we are today. And that's where, you know, contemporary economics is very weak on money and credit and dismissive of the importance, this vital importance of money as a store of value.
Well, so what's interesting, and this is also kind of in contrast to the view that Richard Duncan has that capitalism is dead and creditism has taken its place, you would say, no, quite the opposite. There is an alive and vibrant capitalism in the real world economy, but there is another corrupted form of capitalism, which is in the finance sector. And it exists today at excessive levels because of the change in the definition and use of money, and therefore the expansion of credit. So if you're looking for a place to sort of refine, regulate, control, rework, it is in the finance sector, but actually there is a vibrant capitalism in the real world economy that is sort of a separate and distinct kind of capitalism from what you have in the halls of finance.
Right. This is a very distorted, unhealthy capitalism. But I just continue to call it capitalism, and I expect for the rest of my life I'm going to be defending capitalism. Capitalism has not failed us. Finance has failed us. As I've argued, I don't think capitalism can function very well in the real economy if on the financial end you have unlimited amounts of cheap finance, because that distorts the allocation of financial resources, that distorts the allocation of real resources. It leads to huge excesses in speculation, huge distortions in the nature of savings and investment. As we've seen, that type of a backdrop leads to an economy that loses its vibrancy, has huge inequality, social tension, a lack of productivity. So that's why if we want to get to the root of the problem here, we've got to direct our attention to finance. And on the finance side, get again to the heart of money and credit, get the government out of this so we can start to have financial markets that function more normally, that are self-adjusting, self-correcting. I would love it if we had a gold standard. Unfortunately, I don't see that as feasible. So what we have to do is do the best we can to structure a financial sphere that's self-regulating, that has a limited supply of finance. So when you have a demand for that finance, that price is determined by the interaction of supply and demand. And if you have significant demand for finance, the price goes up and it'll regulate itself.
You're also arguing that under what Jim Grant would call the PhD standard, that self-regulation does not happen. It cannot happen because that's the nature of a discretionary monetary policy. The PhD standard is where you have today at present 700 PhDs running our monetary policy, and they do believe that their decisions are better than anything that would happen on a normal consequential basis in the marketplace, that they can in fact manage the whole process for a better outcome. But again, they're impossible to bring together, the PhD standard and the market being self-regulating.
Yeah, the PhD standard means that a small committee can manage the markets and backstop the markets. And if a speculative market believes that they're going to do that, then they're going to speculate more and feed the bubble. And the larger the bubble, the greater the government meddling, to the point where you have negative interest rates and QE. So the PhD model is an abject failure, except we haven't paid the price in the markets yet. I just look at the real economy, and I think, again, we need to reduce the addiction to credit. And we could do a couple of things. We could do a couple of things that I think would profoundly change the backdrop and move us towards a more stable financial sector. The U.S. economy has been running current account deficits for going on 25 years. That means every year we consume more than we produce, and we basically trade, we import goods and trade financial IOUs. And these IOUs go out into the world and feed excesses out in the world. So if we had a new type of focus where countries were going to balance their current account and central banks had some just clear rules that, let's say, you know, if credit goes above a certain amount, either nominally or percentage-wise, that rates would mechanically rise. Right there, if you did a few things, you would have a much more sustainable system. Instead, you know, the government imposes its will on the marketplace to ensure you have significant credit growth, inflating asset prices, large ongoing current account deficits, which just feed global financial and economic imbalances and lead to this unstable financial and economic backdrop.
In January of this year, it appeared that the global markets were on the edge of dislocation. You then had various central banks come in with promises and props, and the tension seemed to clear. Yeah, that's brought equity markets in the developed world back to higher levels, some stability in the emerging markets selectively. And in the U.S., we're now at record levels. We've done this over and over again. Again, the argument would be, well, gosh, it worked last time. January, we actually began to see a real correction on the edge of what could have been defined as a bear market. If you use the Wall Street bear market terminology or reference of down 20%. And yet here we are, we've forgotten that January even existed because we're going to finish at record numbers for the year. Why not just continue on? Why not just continue on? Are central banks going to be unable to perform the same thing over and over again? Because after all, we've got monetary policy, which is what is still in play, and we haven't even transitioned towards radical fiscal policies yet. We still have all of the fiscal policy rabbits to pull out of the hat.
Right. Going back to January and February, very interesting dynamic in the marketplace. Rightfully so. Market participants were worried that whatever it takes wasn't enough. They were worried that interest rates really couldn't go lower, that QE, you know, central banks had basically used all their ammunition. They were worried that the China credit system, that bubble had burst. But then you saw a dramatic policy response, basically where the Japanese said, we can go as negative as necessary. The ECB said, we'll increase. We can do QE as necessary. We'll buy corporate bonds. The Fed, instead of, you know, starting to raise rates, it was one and done. So that sent a very important message to the markets that it was concerted, whatever it takes, that there was no limit on how low interest rates could go. There was no limit on the size of QE. There was no limit on the type of assets that the central banks were willing to buy. So that was profound in the marketplace. They went from worrying that the game was almost over to, wait, this can go much longer, that these central bankers, there are no limits. And also, I think since February, we've had an enormous short squeeze in the markets. There was a significant bearish positions put on for sound fundamental reasons. There was a lot of hedging in the derivatives markets. And we've seen a major unwind of those hedges and those short positions, and that feeds on itself. And then I mentioned the dislocation in the bond market that I believe has created enormous amounts of liquidity, that's added liquidity into the corporate debt market, their emerging markets. So you've really had a melt up in the markets in the face of deteriorating fundamentals, not unlike late 1999, you know, NASDAQ hit its high in the first quarter of 2000, when as analysts, we were looking and saying, wow, amazing short squeeze in the face of major deterioration in the fundamental backdrop. And then even with subprime cracked in 2007, and it looked like the bubble had been burst, you had an enormous rally in the markets in the face of deteriorating fundamentals. And I often argue, you know, bubbles can go to unimaginable extremes and then double. And also things get crazy at the end. You get this, you know, dislocation in the market, you get these short squeeze dynamics. And that's what we've seen over recent months. I think it's really unhealthy, but everyone got bullish again. And the perception is central bankers have it all under control. But at the same time, I always follow financial stocks closely. They're always a good indicator of the health of the system. And I believe Italian bank stocks are down 50% so far this year. European bank stocks, I believe it's 30. Japanese bank stocks, I believe, are down 40%. U.S. financial stocks are negative. They've lagged the market badly. So there are indications that all is not well. And I think at the end of the day that central banks are putting the global banking system in a very perilous position, inflating these asset markets, distorting the economy, and these obligations end up on commercial bank balance sheets. You know, they end up holding a lot of central bank credit, and they end up extending a lot of loans into a bad part of the cycle. So this is very detrimental for the banks, and I think people should focus on what's going on kind of below the surface of record stock prices.
Is there a bit of irony in the 2007-2008 period, beginning a cycle of interventionism by the world central banks, you know, to save the too big to fail institutions? And now the central bank policy, which has continued on for the last 7 or 8 years, may in fact be responsible for the death of some of these big entities.
Absolutely. And I've argued a few things. You know, we took too big to fail for major financial institutions. We've taken too big to fail for global financial markets and global asset markets. You know, I used to argue during the mortgage finance bubble, I talked about the moneyness of credit. Government intervention had turned, you know, able to transform very risky mortgage debt into AAA rated liquid, you know, securitizations. We had made credit money. This cycle, and I've argued this for recent years, this has been about the moneyness of risk assets. Central banks have tried to make risk assets money-like. And it's always this perception. If the markets perceive something as liquid and safe, that's often where the crisis will occur, because a lot of money will flow into an area with that belief of liquidity and safety. And if all of a sudden the market sees that their perceptions were misguided, then they quickly want to get their money back. That's when you have a crisis. And that's part of the dilemma right now, is these central banks have so distorted the markets, where you've literally had trillions of dollars flow into what are perceived safe assets. And that's the perceived lower risk spectrum of equities, corporate credit, obviously sovereign debt. And that's where the biggest bubble is. The central bankers have convinced the markets through their interventions and QE that these financial markets are liquid, that they'll always be liquid. And that is very dangerous. You know, back in 1998, the perception in the markets were the West will never allow a collapse in Russia. Well, it was that faith, that confidence that led to a lot of illiquidity in Russian instruments, a lot of derivative trading. And when the crisis came, you had a big blow up. There was a perception throughout the mortgage finance bubble that Washington will never allow a crisis in housing. will never allow a crisis in mortgage-backed securities. Well, it's that perception of safety that led to the excesses, which ensured a crisis. So today, central bankers trying to ensure there's never a crisis, well, that creates the backdrop for, unfortunately, I fear, you know, the biggest crisis ever.
So convinced of liquidity, people are treating Italian bonds almost the same as German bonds, with there being maybe a 20, 25 basis point difference in the spread between them. And what you're suggesting is that when people all of a sudden look at them with a more objective view, they'll recognize the difference in credit quality between the Italian and German. And all of a sudden, in that moment, there's no one on the other side who's willing to, with open arms, take on and buy, provide a bid for Italian debt as opposed to German debt. So today it trades at a very comparable price, very competitively, relatively speaking, and that can disappear, be unhinged in a moment. But you're also saying that you see the same kinds of strange pricing dynamics with corporate bonds, with junk bonds, with emerging market debt, with dividend payers, with low volatility stocks, the kinds of things where people have plowed into because they can't get the magic 5% from their bank deposits to make ends meet as a retiree or as a pension fund or an insurance manager, portfolio manager. They're having to get more creative, and it's creating a crowding effect in an area where you wouldn't normally expect to have liquidity, wouldn't ordinarily expect to have liquidity, but today you're convinced that you have all that you'll ever need.
Yeah, this is very complex material. Let's take, for example, the hedge fund universe. The hedge funds have a lot of institutional clients, pension funds, endowments. They need 8% return. How do they get 8%? Well, the leverage number's the plug. If the yields come down in corporate debt, they're going to leverage to get that 8% yield. That's one distortion. You also have this distortion in the markets where the government involvement is so egregious that it's very difficult to do fundamental analysis, to analyze risk, to analyze return. Active management's out of favor because a lot of active managers are trying to navigate around the risk. And if they see the risk start to come to a head, they're going to pull back exposure. And then if central banks intervene, then they miss a rally and their performance suffers and they lose assets. So the assets, because of this backdrop, have gravitated into the indexes. Why not just, okay, I'll just invest in corporate debt. I'll just invest in this fund to get this yield. So that's moved completely away from fundamentals, completely away. I mean, risk doesn't even enter into the question. So you've had the ETF industry grow to $3 trillion. You know, I couldn't believe the hedge fund industry went to $3 trillion. I think it was at $35 billion when I started back in 1990. So you have all these dynamics that distort the market. But now, even when risk is so high and the central banks are in desperate measures, you have a wall of liquidity going in to play yields, not even concerned what the risk is, because, you know, they want to get the yield. So the markets have been so distorted, I say, in this type of an environment, it's not even investing. Because to invest, you look at fundamentals, you look at risk, potential reward, and you make a very careful calculation. There's no calculation going here. It's like, I need a return, or this fund made this much last year, and the money just flows in. And that's part of what has turned this into just a huge speculative bubble. Again, it's the moneyness of risk assets, where I don't think investors have conviction in the asset. This is purely chasing returns. And when the returns turn negative, you'll have outflows and, you know, the downside of a difficult market cycle.
Well, as Kevin mentioned in the introduction, you know, one of your specialties through the years has been shorting the markets and recognizing opportunities to do so. And as asset prices fall, actually benefiting on the downside. And so that brings to mind, what do you do when you get to a point of excess in the markets? You've had a market melt up in the face of deteriorating fundamentals, but bubbles, as you said, can get to extreme levels and then double from there. So shorting the market is not for the faint of heart. It's also not for the person inclined to do this on their own. I mean, this is an expertise you've had for 25, 30 years. What else would you do? If you want to protect on the downside with having a short portfolio, What else makes the most sense if you're managing intergenerational wealth?
Yeah, in this environment, it is very challenging to develop a sound investment strategy. From my perspective, the risk reward in securities is very unattractive. That's corporate debt, sovereign debt, that's equities. I haven't been managing money for what, the last 18 months. I've been watching on the sidelines, and as an analyst of bubbles with a specialty on the short side, I've been happy to be watching from the sidelines because, as I said, things get crazy at the end. My focus is I'm getting geared up for a change in the environment, and I think a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity on the short side. It will not be easy. These are going to be treacherous markets, but I think they're definitely the best opportunities of my career unfolding. I don't know the timing of when this unfolds. I know that I'm, you know, picking up the pace of my analysis right now, getting my analysis together, getting ready for this opportunity. But the volatility right now is very, very difficult to play and to know what the best strategy is.
Well, it is particularly challenging, as you say, when fundamental analysis or a thoughtful process going in is discounted. You know, you'd expect to see a rise in risk premiums with greater stresses in the financial system. Yet central bankers so willing to use their balance sheets as a giant sort of mop cleaning up the mess, risk premiums have all but disappeared. We don't have the signals, the things that would tell you that instability and fragility are all around us. Interest rates being one of those key tools have become an unreliable gauge. And it seems that this environment is particularly dangerous because no one is looking at that and saying that in itself is a problem. When you can't get a read on risk or a benchmark for risk, when that's completely been distorted, and then you just throw caution to the wind. As you say, the response is not to hunker down to try to figure out how best to navigate these waters. It's just, look, I must have a return on investment, and I'll go where I can to get it, or I'll be out of a job. That seems fairly reckless.
It's reckless. Unfortunately, it's rational. In the environment that's been created by the central bankers, people have to plan ahead to try to have savings to put their kids through college. Financial advisors, they're doing the best they can for their clients, but they also know that if they don't participate in a strong rally, they're not going to have a job. Same with fund managers. I wish the market signals were more helpful. I'm trusting that they will be in the future. And let me throw out, I should have probably thrown this out in my last answer to your question. What I do personally, I don't own stocks. I don't own bonds. For myself, it's a barbell approach. I want hard assets, and that's gold, silver, precious metals. I want real estate that I think is special, and I'm going to hold cash for future opportunities and for safety. As a professional with a focus on the downside of the market, I am going to be waiting for a tightening of financial conditions. That's my analytical framework. If I see a tightening of financial conditions, if I see risk aversion, de-risking, deleveraging in the marketplace, like we saw back December, January, February, that's when I turn more constructive on shorting select stocks, groups, the market. But then if you get a policy response and that policy response leads to a market loosening, leads to risk embracement, leads to short covering, more speculative leveraging, then I have to back off again and wait for a better opportunity in the marketplace.
So, I mean, a couple things that you've just said. One is that to play the short side of the market, you don't always have to be short. You just always have to be nimble. And that is ready for when an opportunity emerges, willing to make a tough decision tactically, and then willing to reverse course in the case that there is a policy response to that financial deterioration. That's wonderful. I mean, what I just heard you explain in terms of a barbell approach, I've used those words precisely with a few friends to say, look, this is so simple, you don't even need a napkin to put it on. Ordinarily, when you describe something that's very, very simple, cut and dry, you say, well, I'll just write it down on the back of a napkin. You don't even need the napkin. The barbell approach and having real assets on the one hand, cash on the other, that probably is the best strategy. in the environment we're in. You can make it more complex than that. You can bring stocks and bonds into the mix. In some instances, you have to if yield and income is a requirement. But again, your risk has to be carefully managed in that environment. But the ideal situation is to not take risk when the reward is lacking. And that's what you're saying. We're in an environment where risk and reward are not in balance. Reward's not on offer and you're being asked to take far more risk than you can even fathom, given the amount of leverage in the system, given the fragility of the derivatives market, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, excellent, excellent. And we have no idea, and I devote an enormous amount of time trying to get a gauge of this. I have no idea what the future risk profile looks like because I don't know the policy response. I suspect the Fed's balance sheet is on its way to $10 trillion. I suspect they're not going to have any choice but to do more QE. But I don't know what they're going to do. I don't know what the dollar's going to do. I can see a scenario where right now everybody's bullish on the dollar just like they were back in 1999, King Dollar. So there's a lot of unknowns. I don't know what unfolds in China. The geopolitical backdrop to me is incredibly uncertain and frankly, quite scary. So I've always said this, and actually this goes back watching CNBC. You get a lot of market commentators and I would listen to them and often they were so articulate and eloquent and I was saying, God, I wish I could be so confident. But for me, the markets are so humbling and I have enough scars 25 years in the market where I try to know what I don't know. And I often say, and this is an important part, as a manager of people's assets, my job is not to predict. My job is not to predict. It's to have a sound analytical framework to work very hard to be on top of developments, to be able to react. And I think all of us need to appreciate right now, it is not investing, it's speculating. We don't know what the risk profile is. We don't know what the future has to hold. And we're going to have to react. There are going to be some major decisions that we're going to have to make to protect ourselves and to even profit going forward. But it's going to take a lot of focus, a lot of determination, hard work, and a lot of discipline to play this well going forward. A real challenge, but an exciting challenge.
Well, I hope you come off the sidelines because it's not a skill set that I think many people have and something that I think many people would in fact benefit from. We are going to have to react. We're going to have to stay nimble. And as you say, if you don't bring humility with you to the investment markets, the market will provide it for you. It will give you plenty of it. And so we thank you for sharing your thoughts with us. I can't say strongly enough how important the Credit Bubble Bulletin has been for me this last decade. One, thank you for your weekly blood, sweat, and tears that goes into that. I know the hours that it takes to construct an article 1/10 the size of what you produce. So not only is it prolific, but it's also very dense in terms of the content that's put into it, worth every minute reading. And would encourage our listeners to look at the Credit Bubble Bulletin. And if you haven't followed Doug Noland to begin that process, it's well worth your time spending some time at his site.
Well, David, thank you so much. Those are such kind words. It means a lot. The CBB has been a labor of love for me. And to hear you speak kindly is very appreciative. And you're a blessing what you're doing. What I'm doing is nothing compared to your efforts and what you do for listeners and readers. And thank you for your efforts. And thank you very much for having me today.
Oh, great to have you. Look forward to having you back.
Well, Dave, that was quite comprehensive. If you had to summarize or just come up with a single thought ending this program, what would you say summarizes Doug's thoughts?
Well, in Doug's words, it would be, don't be stretched out. You need to rein in risk. And now is the time to get your financial household in order.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Doug Noland. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.